CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here's your host, Katie Comley.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, voting in the AMS sub-renew Save the UPass referendum continues. Things are going to get a little darker as the world turns off their lights tomorrow for the much-publicized Earth Hour. And on commentary, Phil Caudry looks at some of the challenges ahead to make Vancouver a smoke-free zone. We'll have all this, plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour right here on News 101. But first, here with us today, we have Tristan Markle, who's the newly elected VP admin from UBC's Alma Mater Society, to talk with us about the ongoing AMS referendum. And Tristan, thanks for coming in and being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
First of all, I know people are very focused on the two major issues of this referendum, which are to save the UPass and renew the sub. Save the UPass is a little more black and white. People know what's going on. But the sub, people are a little confused as to what the plan actually looks like and how the increases are going to work. So I was wondering if you could explain about that.
Sure. The sub is the Student Union Building, and it has the word Student Union in it because it was built by the Student Union in a similar referendum in 1964. And that passed the second time. The first time the referendum was run in 63, it failed, and they tried again in the fall. And that was built with student fees. The university pitched in one-third, but it's important to realize that it's a student union building, so it's run and controlled by student union. So it has a different kind of environment and space, and students can have control over that building. It's different than Brock Hall or other kinds of buildings that are run by the administration. So two things came into making sub-renew happen this year. And one thing is that this building is too small for what we need, and we know we need a new one. And then the question of when that's going to happen was related to the political situation surrounding U Boulevard, where the university administration wanted to create something like a social building for students, but it was going to be designed by the administration. I shouldn't say for students, a social building at the center of campus, and it was market retail, market housing, and a student petition stopped that and created a space where it was possible for a student union to put a student union building in the center of campus. So that's the two streams. One, we need a new building, and one, that it's a political necessity to make a student-controlled space this year when we have the chance.
So the referendum, essentially, if the student union building is defeated, if the motion to renew the sub is defeated, does that pave the way for more retail space and private business being placed in UBC?
Yes.
Unquestionably?
Unquestionably. If the referendum does not pass, not unquestionably, because if it doesn't pass, right away we plan to find out why, and if it's just the fee was too high or if there wasn't enough awareness. And if it fails by just a small amount and we get a lot of feedback and we can put together another referendum for the fall and then it passes, we might be able to capture this window and still go through with it. But if that doesn't happen, then the underground bus loop will go through, and there are plans that are university-controlled for a center of campus.
What's the timeline looking like for that between, like you said, a referendum might be put to students again in the fall to decide, but how long will the AMS realistically have until the university administration decides to go ahead with their own plans?
It's always hard to tell. It depends on how competent they are and construction prices, but within the year is a good guess.
Okay. And you said the fee increases. How exactly is that going to work? I know it's a scale that will increase up until 2016, and that's got a bunch of people concerned.
Mm-hmm. So the logic of the fee, it was put together by various committees of the student union and then decided by the student union at large in a big discussion. And the fee starts at $20, which is low, and then it increases. And the reason for increasing is that rather than have a flat fee all the way through, people thought it wouldn't be fair for people to pay the full fee right at the start. And so it's lower at the front and higher at the back end. That's the logic for that. The logic for the back end, the maximum level, which will be in 2016, is that with inflation, it's the same fee as students voted on in 1964. And that time, they didn't have a graduate fee. They just paid the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of students say, why should I do this when I won't be here to be in the new building? And that's a fair question. But in 1964, students did it, and we have the building because of them.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Moving away from the issue of the sub, there are other issues on the referendum ballot. Could you explain to us a little bit about those? People might not know.
Mm-hmm. The UPass is the best and cheapest universal bus program in the country, and it was also initiated by the student union, not by the administration. It's important to realize that we have different, you know, incentives, and the student union is run by members. It's ours, right? If we want to overturn any decisions, we can put together a referendum, we can go to AGM. It's our thing. So that's a student union initiative. And this year, every 3 years, it comes up for renewal. So there's a new contract, and it has to be legally voted on by the members of student union. So everyone vote.
That's great. And there's another issue about, I don't have the name of the association right, but Canadian... WUSC, Canadian University sponsoring refugee students to come study here at UBC. Yeah. And that's to provide funding to the program?
Yes, yeah, so the WUSC refugee program has been in there for a while, and they want to increase the number of refugee students that they're able to accommodate. I believe the fee was $1, and they want to add, or it was $1.50, and they want to add an extra $1 onto that so that another refugee can come over. It's a really important thing to do. A lot of my friends from Africa and other countries are here only because of that program, and it's really important, and I can't...
You can't stress it enough. Yeah. Is there any other... is there anything else to do with the referendum? Why you think it's important that students should go out and vote, and why are they obligated as UBC students? I know a lot of people are like, my vote doesn't matter, but what do you have to say to those people?
Well, not just as UBC students, but as humans, it's important to vote for the refugee one. As citizens of the world in the time of climate chaos, it's important to take the bus. And as, you know, democratic, you know, in a democratic world, what we want is for communities to have control over where they are, and to build a student union building will make it so that we can reverse the privatization trend that's been going on spatially on campus. And I see it as part, personally, of a bigger puzzle. And unfortunately, the farm referendum didn't make it onto the referendum this year, but the original goal was to have the referendum be save the UPass, new sub, save the farm. And that's three student initiatives that are all linked together in terms of the environment, in terms of sustainable building and green building and democracy. So those things are all connected, and hopefully we can move forward on them all and change the climate in general on campus.
Do you think the UBC farm will be something that will appear on a referendum in the future, or do you hope that will appear in a referendum?
I really hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that's great. Anything else you'd like to add?
Oh,
or just where can people get out and vote? Or
yep, there's a... Online voting continues until Monday, and you vote on the Student Services Center website. That's where your grades and your timetable are. And there's a web vote option. You vote there. You vote on each of the different referenda separately. And you can also vote paper balloting on Monday, which is the last day.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Tristan, for coming in.
Okay, thanks.
Great. Now with us, we have our friends from Radio Free UBC with their take on what's happening in and around campus. So without further ado, here's Radio Free.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Free. On today's program, major scandal in the AMS, an interview with Nathan Crompton about Student Council's recent decision to reject a ruling of student court.
There are four articles today in the UBC, and the title page reads Scandal in Student Council. So Nathan, what are they talking about?
What is the scandal about? Well, there were elections in January that took place all across campus. And this election pertains particularly to the VP academic race. The candidate voted for himself four times, so he voted for himself multiple times. And as a result, student court ruled on Wednesday, just 2 days ago, that voting for yourself multiple times is a major violation of electoral code and a major violation of the AMS bylaws and constitution altogether, and just a violation of basic principle of democracy, one person, one vote. The ruling was pretty clear coming out of student court. It was 3 judges to 1. One judge dissented. And what resulted was the scandal. So even though the court ruling was very clear, and even though the court is the highest decision-making body, I'll read from bylaws. The court is the final interpreter within the society of the meaning of constitution, bylaws, and code of the society. Even though that's the case, what happened was, because this candidate who voted for himself multiple times is currently the vice president of the AMS, and because he's currently in the government with a lot of supporters and a lot of friends in the government, what happened was the government decided to completely ignore the ruling of student court. So on the day that the student court ruling was released, council then decided to basically, in a very undemocratic way, intervene in the electoral process.
What does this say then about the AMS?
Well, I guess it says two things. Completely leaving aside the corruption of individuals and the fact that it's about a clique pursuing their own political interests, as leaving all of that aside, just institutionally, it's a huge problem, because in any government system, if you think of the Canadian system and the American system, there's always a division of powers. There's a separation between the executive wing of government and the judiciary wing. And you can't have, and then oftentimes the legislature is separate, the legislative wing. What we have in the AMS, essentially, it's basically a loophole in the constitution, in the bylaws, is what we have is that student court is able to basically disregard, student union is basically able to disregard student court, although it's not clear. It says student union, the student council, is supposed to receive the ruling of student court, and it says that student court is the highest body. So there's supposed to be the separation of powers to ensure that there's no serious conflict of interest, but especially on matters of elections. So basically what you've had now is an elected body has been able to police their own elections. Essentially, they've acted as both, in my analogy, they've acted as both the legislature and the judiciary branch of government, so they've completely concentrated power in their own hands.
So you've been included in many of the UBC articles. How have you directly been involved?
I specifically ran in this election. I ran against Alex Loheed, and I lost to him by 25 votes. I found out about the multiple voting about 2 weeks after the results. I decided not to challenge the results. When I first heard back, people encouraged me to do a recount because it was so close, but I decided I was going to just go on to other things. But when I found out 2 weeks later about the cheating, I decided to pursue the case in student court, and I worked up through the appeals process and went to the final student court hearing.
All right, so in light of this, we've heard that you've started a petition?
Yeah, not just myself. There are about eight people met yesterday to work on a petition, and we're starting a petition that's it's short and very clear, and it's just calling for an immediate by-election, because that's essentially what the student court called for. The student court said that the AMS should decide what it wants to do because their vice president has been disqualified, and the executive of the student society decided to run to hold by-elections. So what we're saying, but that was overturned by student council. So what we're saying in this petition that we're circulating is we request that the AMS council accept the ruling of student court and hold an immediate by-election for the position of the VP academic.
All right, so you're calling for a by-election. Is this an opportunity for you to run again?
No, I don't plan on running again, no. I'm graduating in 2 weeks, sir.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. So I guess watch out for that petition. Everyone should really be paying attention to this issue. Thank you very much for coming on to Radio Free.
Yeah, I think you can see the petition at stsubc.ca.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Now we have some announcements.
Okay, tonight we have a fundraiser for Palestinian Solidarity Week. It's the Shisha chai and dessert at 7 to 9 in the second floor of the sub in the courtyard. Tickets are $7 at the door. There's another fundraiser for the Sexual Assault Center at the gallery starting at 7:30. Tomorrow, the 29th, there's a lecture and book signing by Ilan Pape to end as an ending for Palestinian Solidarity Week at the Vancouver Public Library in the Alice McKay Room, admission by donation. Also tomorrow, there's a rally, 1,000 strong, for ancient forests, rallying around BC's ancient forests and as to ban raw log exports from 12 to 1 o'clock in the Legislative Building in Victoria. On Friday, April 4th, we're having NOLE Aid too, so everybody should come and check that out.
And that's Radio Free UBC. Thank you very much, you guys. And we're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
Because to have a democratic society, you need to have a vibrant, healthy...
AMS.
It's axiomatic. It's the cornerstone of democratic theory.
Democracy is in the air again here on UBC campus. The Alma Mater Society referenda will be held March 25th to 31st, and a number of hot topics are going to be on the ballot.
With the UPass contract expiring this year, UBC students need to come out in force to support the new contract, or the UPass will be lost next year.
Since the Student Union building was built 40 years ago, the student population has more than doubled. The Sub is the least sustainable building on the UBC campus, and it's time for a better building that reflects students' needs.
Keep your eyes peeled for more information or check out the AMS website at www.ams.ubc.ca. If you would like to get involved, you can email referendum@ams.ubc.ca.
You need to have a wide range of opinions on the important issues of the day so people can formulate their own opinions.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
William Shatner. Imagine a children's hospital network that boldly goes where none have gone before, and that's Shriners Hospitals for Children. Shriners Hospitals combine state-of-the-art research and teaching programs with world-class orthopedic burn, spinal cord injury, and cleft lip and palate medical care. At Shriners, tomorrow's medical care is here today. Call 1-800-361-7256 for more information. Shriners, having fun and helping kids.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:20. Now with a look at local and provincial news, here are reporters Leanne Yu, Tracy Fuller, and Carrie Baptist.
The latest change in anti-smoking laws is going to be bad for business, according to the majority of bar owners in the province. But one pub owner in Coquitlam is looking on the bright side. Vicki Cartwright from Woody's on Brunette is offering her staff incentives to kick the habit. If staff can quit smoking for 3 months, Woody's Pub will reimburse their treatment costs, whether it's prescription medication, patches, or hypnotism. The pub is also reaching out to its customers and is teaming up with a local laser therapy company. A series of draws and giveaways will offer customers the opportunity to quit smoking with the help of laser therapy. Woody's has invested almost $100,000 in renovations to keep up with the ever-changing smoking laws. But rather than be bitter, Vicki Cartwright says she's just trying to turn a negative into a positive.
The city of Delta may be on the brink of an American bullfrog invasion. Delta Councillor Vicki Huntington motioned for the study of American bullfrogs after one was found at the edge of a local bog. She hopes scientists can find out the exact size of the population and how to control it. The bullfrogs can weigh up to 1.5 pounds, and the species' fast breeding abilities mean that the bullfrogs can squeeze out another species from their habitats. Females can lay 20,000 eggs at a time. American bullfrogs are fierce carnivores, preying on ducklings, fish, and even other frogs. Biologist Stan Orchard says American bullfrog infestations have been the cause of headaches all across the globe. He suggests the best way to contain it is to find the outermost perimeter of the infestation and work your way in. Orchard says the bullfrogs should be captured and killed.
Vancouver's beloved Hollow Tree may very well have its days numbered. The iconic cedar has already been dead for many years, but windstorms of late have been causing the tree to lean at a dangerous 11-degree tilt. For 3 decades, the tree has been held up by a $200,000 system of braces and supports. Park Board staff recommend laying the tree to rest. It is estimated that the tree is 800 years old. Vancouverites have mixed feelings regarding this historic cedar. An online poll conducted by the Vancouver Sun reveals 59% of voters are in favor of cutting down the tree. The other 41% think the money is worth it to keep a part of the city's heritage standing. One respondent retorted, "Yes, let's pay over 200 grand to save a hollow tree and keep those single mothers living on the street." Another respondent says, "To artificially keep it alive is obscene." However, a woman from Switzerland begs for the city to save its heritage. She suggests planting another special tree in its place.
The final destination for Vancouverites' garbage may soon be in Washington State. Metro Vancouver officials have voted for a plan to send our garbage south of the border. They are now waiting for the go-ahead from the provincial government. For the past 2 decades, the city's garbage has been sent to a landfill in Cache Creek near Kamloops. But the Cache Creek dump is expected to reach capacity by 2010, leaving the board to seek alternatives. Original plans for another site to open up in the interior haven't panned out. Waste Committee Vice Chairman Peter Ladner says the Washington plan is a short-term solution. The board is hoping down the road the city will be able to burn the trash to generate power. But Cache Creek Mayor John Ranta says residents are uneasy about losing jobs revolving around waste in the interior. He adds officials should be trying to protect jobs in BC for BC residents to the greatest extent possible.
Concerns are being raised over a closed-door meeting of the TransLink Board of Governors. The board of the Greater Vancouver Transit Authority is met today to decide how to offset last year's budget deficit. TransLink has the option of levying a new tax on business or homeowners in the Lower Mainland. Several interest groups showed up to protest TransLink's closed-door policy. They argued that because taxpayers are paying the bills, they should be allowed to observe the decision-making process. A member of one group, James Stadel, told reporters that he has to file an access of information request just to get a copy of the proposed meeting agenda. When he received the document, large sections were blacked out. The groups were also concerned that people who wanted to give their input were only given 24 hours notice of the meeting. TransLink Chairman Dale Parker responded by saying the meeting has been well publicized.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll update you on national and international news. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
Mm-hmm. Want to see your film up on the big screen?
The Vancouver Student Film Festival is back to showcase the best of BC's post-secondary student and alumni film and video makers on May 24th.
The film festival is looking for entries of all genres, from student or graduate filmmakers within the last 3 years. Films received by March 1st are only $10 and $20 until April 19th.
Only 2 weeks left before the early entry deadline. For entry rules and to submit online, please visit www.vsff.com.
Let the cartoons begin!
The Leo Ramirez Show, the best mix of Latin American music, news, sport, and commentary from around the local and international Latin American communities. Saturday, 5 to 6 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. El show de Leo Ramirez, la mejor mezcla de música, noticias, deportes y comentarios de la comunidad latinoamericana. Sábado de 5 a 6 de la tarde en el 101.9 FM CITR.
If you haven't heard already, CITR 101.9 FM is having its second That DJ competition.
That DJ competition is a killer party of wonderful music, dance, and of course, DJs.
Yes!
We'll have some of Vancouver's best aspiring DJs compete for their chance to win several amazing prizes, soon to be disclosed.
If you were at the last DJ competition, or if you missed your chance, this is the time to recapture the moment.
The event will take place Thursday, April 3rd, 2008, at the Pid Pub, located in the Student Union Building at UBC. For additional information, please email thatdjcompetition2008@gmail.com.
Oh, yeah.
Five 28, and the news continues on CITR. Now with a look at national and international news, we're joined in studio once again by our News 101 reporters, Carrie Baptist, Leanne Yu, and Tracy Fuller.
Canadian forces will have to use borrowed tanks in their combat mission until 2011. Federal tendering documents have revealed that 100 Leopards recently purchased from the Netherlands will not be ready for service for 3.5 years. Those are Leopard tanks. The vehicles are currently being refurbished, but the first delivery of 20 tanks is not expected till 2011, just as Canada's troops are slated to withdraw from Afghanistan. Canadian troops are currently using tanks on loan from Germany. The delay in the delivery of the Dutch tanks means the loan will likely need to be extended. Retired Colonel Chris Corrigan says he is not surprised the Defense Department is struggling to update the tanks because Canada simply does not have the industrial base for military upgrades.
A local health unit in Ontario is calling for the provincial drinking age to be raised from 19 to 21. The Middlesex London Health Board wants the drinking age lowered because they say it will reduce traffic accidents involving young drivers who are impaired. The board is pressing the Association of Local Public Health Agencies in Ontario to endorse the plan. A higher drinking age is facing opposition from young people who argue that it will not change the reality of teen drinking. Mary Lou Albanese, an author of the plan, said she realizes an attempt to raise the drinking age could be met with some opposition from teens and students. Albanese suggests that a compromise could be reached leaving the drinking age at 19, but making it illegal for drivers to have any alcohol in their blood until they're 21.
The family of a jailed Chinese human rights activist, Hussein Selil, are asking for the help of the federal government in locating their son in the Chinese prison system. Selil, a member of China's Uyghur Muslim ethnic minority, was arrested in Uzbekistan 2 years ago and extradited to China, where he faced a life sentence after being found guilty on terrorism charges. Since then, his family in southern Ontario has sent a letter to Prime Minister Stephen Harper to, quote, renew and fortify Canada's effort to ensure Mr. Salil's human rights are protected, and to ask Beijing for more information. Despite assurances from the Chinese government made last year to then Foreign Minister Peter MacKay that Selil had not been tortured while in prison, his family maintains that he has been brutally maltreated. The Chinese government has tended to view ethnic minority activists, such as Uyghurs and Tibetans, as separatist movements that threaten national security. And certain Uyghur groups in particular have been reported to have had links to fundamental Islamist groups.
And in international news, a missing New York City boy has been found in South Korea thanks to an anonymous tip on his mother's MySpace page. The anonymous witness identified the location of the 7-year-old's school. Tiffany Rubin, the mother of the boy, flew to South Korea with investigators from two different missing children's organizations. They checked out the school, finding that there wasn't a lot of security, and then Tiffany Rubin brought her son to the U.S. Embassy before heading home to the States on Wednesday. The young boy, Kobe Lee, was missing since August 21st, when he and his father, Jeffrey Salco, disappeared during a visit. At the time, Salco was facing a jail sentence for not paying child support. The FBI is trying to work with South Korea to secure the father's arrest and extradition. Calls to his family have been unanswered. About 800,000 American children go missing every year, and about 200,000 of children, those children are abducted by family members.
And finally, tomorrow night at 8 p.m. local time, people from around the world will be turning off their lights for 1 hour to make a statement about climate change. It's called the Earth Hour, and the event was created in Sydney, Australia last year by the World Wildlife Fund. In only a year, the event has become a global phenomenon. So whether you're at home or at work, if you want to participate, just turn off your lights between 8 and 9 p.m. For more information on the event, visit earthhour.org. And if you're on Facebook, you can add the Zero Footprint Calculator to calculate your own carbon footprint. It's time now for another break here on News 101, but stay tuned for commentary and much more coming up on the other side.
Better environmentally sound transportation is proud to offer bike valet parking to events in Metro Vancouver. Inspired by the widely successful valet parking in San Francisco, 2 years ago, Best began running bike valet in Vancouver with great results. Enjoyed themselves worry-free. This year, Best is expanding bike valet to serve more events, park more bikes, and make traveling on two wheels throughout Metro Vancouver even easier. Contact Best at 604-669-2860 or CAM at best.bc.ca for more information about volunteering, sponsorship opportunities, and booking bike valet for your event.
Hi, I'm Kirsty.
And I'm Sheila.
And we're both single moms. We started SPOC UBC, Single Parenting on Campus, an AMS club, with the hope of drawing attention to the additional challenges single parenting students face on our campus. We want to create a space for single parenting students to find resources and support.
Our first meeting will be held on Tuesday, November 6th from 11 to 12:30 at the Women and Gender Studies WAGS building right next to Brock Hall. We welcome all single parenting students and, of course, allies. And please remember that your children are always welcome.
Please help us spread the word by informing any single parenting students that you know about our group. We're also open to receiving anecdotes or stories from single parent students regarding their time spent at UBC.
Feel free to drop by our meeting on November 6th or send us an email at spoc.ubc@gmail.com. We really look forward to hearing or seeing you.
CITR 101.9 FM presents our second That DJ competition at the Pit, Thursday, April 3rd, 2008.
CITR Second That DJ Competition is looking for the most versatile party DJ in Vancouver.
It's quite simple. 8 DJs play 15-minute sets each, with a minimum of 3 genres of music to keep the party rocking.
There are no restrictions on what audio sources or what music style that DJ chooses to use. DJs must bring their own music and needle and provide their own transportation. The equipment provided will be properly functioning, professional quality equipment.
Interested? Send your demo to The DJ Competition, CITR Radio, 233-6138 Sub Boulevard, Vancouver, BC, V6T1Z1, Canada.
Along with your full name, email address, mailing address, home or cell phone, your musical style, and audio sources used.
MySpace submissions are also accepted. For more information, please visit our website at www.citr.ca or email thatdjcompetition2008, all one word, at gmail.com.
BCSportsBeat.ca is your source on the internet dedicated to providing you with information on professional and amateur sports in your province. You'll find game scores, team updates, and the perspective of the athletes through in-depth interviews, all at BCSportsBeat.ca. BCSportsBeat.ca, your source for BC sports.
Welcome back to News 101. It's now time for commentary, and this week, Phil Caudry discusses the new tough anti-smoking provincial legislation and Vancouver city bylaws. Phil thinks that this is a critical step towards finally making Vancouver a smoking-free environment.
Restaurants and bars in British Columbia are bracing for new anti-smoking regulations at the provincial and civic level that put the onus on operators rather than the smokers to ensure that customers comply with the new rules. These new rules take effect April 1st, and the provincial regulations seem to work within the Healthy BC framework created to make Vancouver and British Columbia a healthier and more livable city as the 2010 Olympics approaches and all eyes are on the province and Vancouver. These rules will outlaw smoking rooms and ban smoking near working place doorways, open windows, and bus shelters in British Columbia. The city of Vancouver is raising the bar and taking it further by making it illegal for smokers to light up in a 6-meter buffer zone located within the immediate vicinity of building entryways. Smoking will also be banned on outdoor patios. This puts pressure on the restaurant sector, where owners will face fines of up to $2,500 if they are found not to be enforcing the new laws. The restaurants and bars have the right to refuse service to people who don't comply with the law. Detractors say that tougher bylaws could put pubs and restaurants near city boundaries at competitive disadvantage, since there are different bylaws governing different cities, such as Burnaby. This is a legitimate concern, but Vancouver is showing leadership on a serious health issue, and Burnaby should be making it a priority to follow suit rather than sticking with the status quo. I feel that this is a great direction for British Columbia and the city of Vancouver to take. It shows true leadership on a tough issue that will certainly create enemies for the city and province among smokers and big tobacco alike. Vancouver is getting very close to finally becoming a smoke-free zone. And the only thing that's really holding it back is enforcement. Having the onus on bar and restaurant owners is an excellent step, since accountability will be less of an issue, since the public can report violators to the Vancouver Coastal Health and an investigation can be made as a result. Banning smoking near bus stops is the best idea in this plan. I frequently used public transportation to get around the city of Vancouver, and there have been countless times I have to breathe in secondhand smoke while I'm waiting for a bus or SkyTrain to arrive. I think this is completely unacceptable, since I do not choose to smoke, and yet I have to take in the effects, which are arguably worse since there's no filter in the air for the smoke. Non-smokers should not have to pay for the habits of smokers and their life choices. However, enforcement for smokers at bus stops will be fairly difficult to implement and marks the difficult last step towards a smoke-free city. I do think it can be possible over time, as universities across Canada have successfully implemented bylaws that have eliminated smoking on their campuses. A smoke-free city is a much larger project, and therefore will take more time. As the city of Vancouver faces a shortage of police officers, I doubt that it will be a priority of the city to enforce non-smoking at bus stops. However, this is a big step towards making Vancouver a smoke-free environment. For News 101 commentary, I'm Phil Caudry.
And thanks for that, Phil. Just to divert a little bit from our usual schedule, we bring you an international story from FSRN.
Since the early 1990s, the ELF has claimed responsibility for dozens of instances of politically inspired property damage, including the 1998 Vail firebombing that was considered the costliest act of eco-terrorism in the country, causing $12 million in damage. On Monday, March 3rd, in Woodinville, Washington, arsonists set fire to three uninhabited but furnished luxury model homes, causing an estimated $7 million of damage. A spray-painted banner at the scene mocked builders' claims that the mansions were environmentally friendly and bore the letters ELF, the initials of the Earth Liberation Front, a decentralized collective of radical environmentalists. Aaron Siegel reports.
Ecoterrorism is defined by the FBI as the use or threatened use of violence of a criminal nature against innocent victims or property by an environmentally oriented subnational group for environmental political reasons or aimed at an audience beyond the target, often of a symbolic nature. Martin R. Stoller is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
It's used as a terror tactic, actually, by the government.
it's used to criminalize dissent and to put it in its worst light. After September 11th, we have had the terrorism attached to every type of thing we can imagine. We've got narco-terrorism, we've got eco-terrorism, we've got terrorism. We've got definitions of terrorism in the U.S. Patriot Act, which basically criminalized dissent and could be used for people who protest government policies. And it's really a scare tactic by the executive branch and the law enforcement branch to quell any kinds of dissent.
Since 2000, the U.S. government has prosecuted over 20 cases involving environmentalists. Notable cases of property damage deemed terror include the case of Jeff Lures, an environmental activist from Los Angeles who was initially sentenced to serve over 22 years for torching empty SUVs in a dealer's parking lot. Priya, also known as Warcry, is a friend and supporter of Jeff Lures.
Eco-terrorism is a term we hear in the media, on the corporate media, and it's a term that actually originated in timber industry PR firms. And that's public relations firms. And then it was picked up by law enforcement. Then it was uncritically, of course, appropriated by the corporate media. And this dangerously ends up biasing political thought and criminal procedure. And it ends up criminalizing dissent.
The FBI is investigating the fires in Woodinville as a potential act of domestic terrorism. Bureau spokesperson Robbie Burrows explains the implications the label will have on the case.
The first is that the FBI becomes the lead investigative agency. We're working with the ATF and with local authorities. But also, even if this was an isolated incident, it would certainly be considered an appalling crime. But designating it an eco-terror incident elevates it to a higher priority for us due to the scope of the problem of eco-terrorists and the links to several other incidents. So that allows us to devote more resources to the investigation, including our JTTF, the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
In 2005, federal authorities charged over a dozen people involved in ELF activities around Olympia, Washington, and Eugene, Oregon. The group claimed responsibility for about 17 fires between 1996 and 2001, most notoriously the 1998 firebombing of Colorado's Vail Ski Resort. Codenamed Operation Backfire, the sting operation involved multiple agencies and investigations, as well as planted undercover agents who infiltrated the ELF. The criminal investigation culminated in the December 7, 2005 arrest of seven people, including New Yorker Daniel McGowan. I spoke with Sean, a friend of McGowan and organizer with the group Family and Friends of Daniel McGowan, about the impact Operation Backfire has had on the environmental movement.
I think it's very stifling. This country has a very proud history of direct action, and we have a lot of issues from war to continuing ecological destruction that are not being addressed by legislators and not being addressed properly through popular means, whether that be through petition or through protest. And I think when people see people being threatened like Daniel was with life plus 335 years for having participated in two actions that resulted in no injury and no loss of life, I think it's stifling for people to kind of think exactly how we can change things and make this place a better world to live.
As of today, weeks after the Washington State arsons, the FBI has not named any suspects. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Aaron Siegel from New York, New York.
And thanks, as always, to Free Speech Radio News for making that piece available to us for rebroadcast. Our producer, Megan Turcotto, is here now with a look at our oddity of the week. Sorry, we're getting the mics repositioned here. And Megan, this week you have a very interesting story about British people fighting for their right to party.
Yes, Katie, British Treasury Chief.
Yes, British Treasury Chief Alistair Darling now bears the dubious distinction of being banned from countless pubs across the United Kingdom after imposing a new tax which raises the price of a pint of beer. Earlier in the month, Darling also raised taxes on the price of both cars and cigarettes, but it is his new tax on beer which has infuriated pub owners and patrons alike. The tax raises the price of a pint of beer by an extra 4 pence, or approximately 8 cents Canadian. Other alcohol, such as cider, up 3 pence a liter, wine up 14 pence a bottle, and hard liquor up 55 pence a bottle. The response of the Utopian pub in Darling's hometown of Edinburgh, Scotland, banned the minister from their pub. Inspired by the move, an internet campaign has now sprung up aimed at banning Darling from pubs across the country. Posters have also been placed in many establishments depicting the minister's face above the word barred in large red letters.
I've got to say, I love the use of pun by putting his face on a poster that says barred. Congrats to every pub owner in Britain who's listening right now, which is probably nil, but very creative. And I don't know, this is kind of unprecedented. Like, what do you think, Megan? Like, banning one person from every pub in an entire country.
Well, I have to say that Darling obviously rocks pretty hard, because I don't know anyone else who's banned from all the pubs in the entire country.
You got to beat up a lot of people and cause a bunch of ruckus to get kicked out of every pub in a country.
Or apparently raise people's beer by 4 pence.
Like, is that really going to dig into the pockets of the average British citizen? I don't know.
I guess it depends how much beer you drink if you, you know, add it up however many glasses a week over the year. Maybe it does cut in.
And it's kind of a national pastime. I mean, you know, there's a pub on every street corner, and it's kind of part of their national heritage. So, yeah, I guess you could see why the British would be up in arms. So, but, the Treasury Chief just took a bad step. I don't know where he's going to go drinking now. In his house?
Yeah, maybe.
Well, thanks, Megan.
Being ostracized by the whole country.
Thanks, Megan. Great oddity choice. And it's break time again, but coming up next, it's the Arts Report with Katie Fitzpatrick. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
CITR podcast update number 1.
Work has begun on Canada's information highway. That's the state-of-the-art network that we're told will change everything from the way we do business to the way we learn. Without getting too technical, tell me how what you're working on is different from what's available to me right now.
So right now, if you want to listen to your favorite CITR program, you need to be listening to it on your radio live or streaming over the internet live. But with CITR podcasts, you'll be able to download your favorite show and listen to it whenever you want on your computer or on your MP3 player.
I'm just thinking about that.
I know, it's pretty rad.
For more information, visit CITR.ca/podcast. Thank you for listening, and please be kind to robots.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Katie Comley, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Right now, it's 5:49 and time to turn things over to Katie Fitzpatrick for a look at the arts.
Hello and welcome to your 5-Minute Arts Beat here on News 101. I'm your host, Katie Fitzpatrick. Now, first, I'm going to let you all know about a few theater events that are going on right now. One of them is Rabbit Hole. The Arts Club Theater Company presents David Lindsay Abrera's play, exploring the possibility of finding hope even in the darkest hour. That's at the Stanley Industrial Alliance stage there on Granville Street till April 13th. And Arts Volunteer Megan Tricato reviewed that on last week's art show and said that it was definitely worth checking out. So that's Rabbit Hole with the Arts Club. Another theater event going on is Foreplay, new work by excited writers. A festival of one-act plays features original work by Studio 58 students under the tutelage of playwright Aaron Bushkowski. That's till March 30th at the Studio 58 at Langara College there on West 49th. Also up in theater, there's another small festival called Tremors. Rumble's Festival of Emerging Arts presents performances of Atomic Vaudeville's Legoland, Zupa Circus Theater's Penny Dreadful, and Rough House's Tiny Apocalypse. You can find more information about this small festival at www.rumbleorg.com. That's till April 5th at Performance Works on Cartwright on Granville Island. Now, if you speak French, or if you're like myself where you understand it well enough, you may want to check out Le Vu dans Eau. Théâtre Le 16e presents the world premiere of a satirical portrait of social realities in the context of the Olympics. It's performed in French and directed by Greg Hotchou. That's till April 5th at Studio 16 on West 7th. That sounds like a pretty socially relevant play, so that may be something worth checking out in order to gain some perspective on some current events. Another theater event going on right now is Poster Boys. This is the other production by the Arts Club, the one they're showing right now at the Granville Island stage on Johnson. It's called Poster Boys. The Arts Club Theater presents Michelle Rimmie's exploration of love, marriage, and the fear of flying in the harsh glare of the media spotlight, starring Louise Anderson and Daniel Arnold. Now, there's also the wrapping up the end of the Vancouver International Dance Festival here in Vancouver. nights featuring more than 20 local, national, and international dance companies in main stage, cabaret, and late night performances. Performers include flamenco fusion dancer Anna Arroyo from Spain, Takatoro Kudo from Japan, Toronto Dance Theatre, Gang Gang Grass from Quebec, Kahawi Dance from Ontario, and many, many others. You can find all the information about this at www.vidf.ca. It goes till March 29th, so you just have a few more chances to go check out some events to do with that. That's at various Vancouver venues. So you'll have to check out the website to find out which one it's at, though most of them are at the Roundhouse Community Center. Another event going on is Pulse. The Tomorrow Collective perform a new version of choreographer Susan Elliott's You Are Here, plus three new solos. You can find more information at thedancecenter.ca. That's at the Scotiabank Dance Center tonight and tomorrow at 8 p.m. And the Scotiabank Dance Center is on Davie. Now, one event that a lot of people are excited about is Sarah Silverman, who's in town at the moment. American actress and writer, a former cast member of Saturday Night Live and the star of Comedy Central's The Sarah Silverman Program, performs a stand-up comedy show. That's at the River Rock Show Theater on River Road there in Richmond, my hometown, and that's tomorrow night at 7:30 and 10 p.m., Sarah Silverman. Now, also in town is Margaret Cho, another big female comedian. The Georgia Strait presents outspoken stand-up comic from the Bay Area with guest Liam Sullivan, a.k.a. YouTube's Kelly. That's March 28th tonight at 8 p.m. at the Queen Elizabeth Theater. Not sure if there's still tickets available for that one, but if there are, it's probably something we're checking out as well. I saw an old clip of Margaret Cho, and I thought she was really funny, but I know she's hated by many as well, so you may want to check her out and get some input on that. Also, a few events going on in music. Tonight, there's Lang Lang Beethoven Festival. The Vancouver Symphony Orchestra presents a six-part Beethoven experience as all nine symphonies are performed in chronological order. Pianist Lang Lang opens the series. That's tonight at 8 p.m., starting at the Orpheum Theater at Seymour and Smythe. Also on tomorrow night is Bolinissimo. The Vancouver Recital Society presents two violinists in a series of two concerts. First, Robbie Lakatos plays with his Hungarian Gypsy Band on the 29th, and then Nikolai Snyder will perform works from Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms on the 30th. You can find more information at bandrecital.com. That's taking place at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts here at UBC on tomorrow, Saturday night, and Sunday night as well. Now, finally, if you're interested in seeing some movies, you may want to go check out festivalcinemas.ca, where they're showing what's showing at the Fifth Avenue Park Theater and Ridge Theater. One thing coming up is the Vancouver Jewish Film Festival. You can find the link there to check out the schedule for that event. Also showing right now at Fifth Avenue Cinemas is Days of Darkness, the new movie following up the Barbarian Invasions. I talked a little bit about it on last week's Arts Express. Many reviewers are liking it, but a lot are saying it's disappointing in comparison to the previous films in this trilogy. Also showing is Up the Yangtze in Mandarin with subtitles. Also the Lebanese romantic comedy Caramel. The Austrian Academy Award winner The Counterfeiters, which I reviewed a couple weeks ago. I really, really enjoyed that one and very much recommend it. And still holding on for some reason, they're also playing Juno at Fifth Avenue Cinemas. So I hope you get a chance to go check out some of those events. Once again, for your 5-Minute Arts Beat, I'm Katie Fitzpatrick.
Thanks, Katie. It's 5:54 and time to turn things over to Thunderbird Ion Sports with Tyler Noble.
All right. Thanks very much, Katie. And apologies for not being in last Friday as well. I had to take the holiday off, the long weekend. So.
Oh, that's okay. You've been working hard yes. And you're at the end of your BCIT career, so you deserve it.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks very much for that, Katie. Well, after a tough weekend last week against Lewis Clark State, the UBC Thunderbird baseball team is back at home this weekend to take on the College of Idaho Yotes. Although their four games last weekend were non-conference affairs, the losses weren't exactly good ones for UBC. After being dumped 11-3 in Game 1 on Saturday, they were blanked in Game 2, 11-zip. And just when you thought that was lopsided, they were lit up 23-8 and 13-6 on Sunday. Nevertheless, the Birds still have a perfect record in conference play and lead the NAIA Region 1 standings with 8 wins. That perfection will be on the line at Nat Bailey Stadium this weekend against Idaho, which currently sits in second place at 6-3. UBC's John Chernick leads the team with an impressive 4.40 batting average in conference play and is tied for the team lead in RBIs with Ryan Pilgrim at 9 apiece. Speaking of Pilgrim, he also leads the squad with 3 home runs and a 7.14 slugging percentage. Mark Hardy has been the ace of the pitching staff so far this season. His numbers in conference play couldn't be much better at this point either. Hardy has made 3 starts, going the distance each time to earn a 3-0 record with a stingy 1.29 ERA. Eric Brown has also made the most of his starts, picking up 2 wins in as many opportunities with a 1.50 ERA. Curtis Schumacher has been nearly untouchable in relief for the Birds, throwing 11.1 scoreless innings in 5 appearances. Last season, UBC went 3-3 against the College of Idaho during conference play. Tomorrow's contests are scheduled for 12 noon and 2:30 p.m., while Sunday's games get underway at 11 a.m. and 2 o'clock. And you can catch all of the action from the Nat on the web at gothunderbirds.ca. Well, the expectations for the UBC track and field teams are high this year, and with the NAIA Championships in St. Louis coming up in just under 2 months' time, both the men's and women's squads are aiming to place in the top 10 in the final standings. Early season competitions are indicating that both teams are on the right track in terms of preparation. Already, 8 athletes have fulfilled the entry requirements for the NAIA Championships. 3 of them got that job done last weekend. The 2007 NAIA Javelin champion Liz Gleedel opened the season placing 2nd at the USC Trojan Invitational in Los Angeles with a 48.45 performance. Gleedel is one of the favorites to win at this year's NAIA Championships. 2 more throwers qualified and achieved the NAIA entry standard at a meet in Eugene, Oregon last weekend. In her first competition of the season, Lara Turutlak set a new PB in the hammer throw and placed 3rd with a 50.45 score. It's the first time Lara threw over the big 50-meter barrier. Also, Sean McIsaac had his best-ever season opener, sending his hammer the distance of 50.58 meters, and that's impressive considering that Sean is also the number one kicker on the UBC football team. The Racewalkers have proven twice already that they're the strongest group in Canada, and they're going to be a major scoring force on the UBC team. The group is led by 3-time NAIA gold medalist, Megan Hussey and Inaki Gomez, who is a silver medalist from last year. 5 female long-distance runners will compete in the marathon in St. Louis. NAIA marathon bronze medalist Fawn Whiting is leading the 2008 ranking, along with Natalie Ball and Nicole Aykroyd, who are right behind in 4th and 6th, respectively. And then there is UBC superstar Mike Mason, who's getting ready for his first outdoor competition. The world-class high jumper will attempt to win the NAIA championships for the 3rd time in a row while continuing to prepare for the Olympic Games in Beijing this year. And to secure a spot, Mike will have to repeat his indoor performance of 2.30 meters in an outdoor environment. Both UBC teams are down in Seattle for the University of Washington outdoor preview today, and there's high hopes that more athletes will be on UBC's team in St. Louis after the dust settles on competition today. Also in action this weekend is men's rugby. They play host to Seattle RFC at Wolfson Field tomorrow afternoon, and both the men's and women's rowing teams are over in Victoria for the annual Brown Cup against the UVic Vikes. That goes tomorrow on the Gorge Waterway. And lastly, Katie, we don't normally report NHL and other pro league scores, but it is crunch time for the Vancouver Canucks. They are currently in action in Minnesota against the Wild, and it is the Minnesota Wild up 2-0 after 1 period of play. The Wild leading the edge in terms of shots, 14-9. Pierre-Marc Bouchard scoring at 11:37 on the power play. Mikko Koivu getting the Wild's 2nd goal at 17:21. And just some other related news that is not good for Canuck fans. The Nashville Predators, who are right behind them in 9th place in the standings, they're up on Columbus 2-0 after 2 periods of play. So if the Canucks lose tonight and the Predators win, they will be tied for the 8th and final playoff spot in the Western Conference. The Canucks do have the tiebreaker, having won the season series, but the Canucks may have to run the table in their final 4 games, all of which are at home next week, but they might need to win at least 3 of them, I would say, to get into the playoffs. So tough times for the Canucks right now.
And the way the Canucks have been playing, do you think that's going to happen, Tyler Noble?
This is the question that everybody's asking one another. I think the Canucks are going to miss the playoffs. Yeah.
Which is very unfortunate. But in some happy Canucks news, Roberto Luongo is a new dad.
Yes, yesterday his wife Gina gave birth to Gabriella Anna Luongo, 7 pounds, 6 ounces, and I'm sure Roberto is a very proud father.
Thanks so much, Tyler. Great to have you in. And to wrap things up, we have our weekend weather forecast with Selena Ferris. Selena?
It's going to be a cold and snowy weekend in some parts of Vancouver. A train of fronts moving in the area will lead to rain and snow across the lower mainland. Overnight, temperatures will be dropping down to 0, so expect a dusting of snow in most areas. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a few sunny breaks, rain for most of Vancouver with snow ending in the morning, a high of 6 degrees. Sunday will be much the same, cloudy with sunny periods, rain with snow for higher elevations, and a high of 7 degrees. Into next week will be similar, cloudy with showers and snow for more higher elevations. That's your weekend weather brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
Thanks, Selena. And that's our program for Friday, March 28th, 2008. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Megan Turcato produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Katie Comley. Thanks for listening. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.